Sure. So thank you. We now move to agenda papers 3A to 3C. So these papers provide our analysis of the feedback on the proposed amendments to IS-12, including the exposure draft, deferred tax related to assets and liabilities arising from a single transaction. We'll start with agenda paper 3A, and this paper includes our analysis of the main comments on the approach proposed in the exposure draft and our preliminary recommendation to the board. Almost all respondents agree with the board's decision to address the accounting for deferred tax related to leases in decommissioning obligations. However, many either disagreed with or expressed some concerns about a number of aspects in the proposed approach. Paragraphs 9 to 43 of the paper identify the main concerns raised by respondents and provide our analysis of these concerns. In our view, the board can address most of these concerns and still achieve its objective in proposing the amendments by confirming its proposals to narrow the scope of the recognition exemption so that it would not apply to transactions that give rise to equal amounts of taxable and deductible temporary differences, but removing what we refer to in the paper as the capping proposal. So remove the proposal to restrict the recognition of a deferred tax liability. Further, we also recommend the board provide an illustrative example explaining the deferred tax accounting for advance lease payments and initial direct costs. So with that, I would now like to ask for your views on the analysis and preliminary recommendations set out in this paper before we move to agenda paper. Thank you.
Hey. Who wants to come in? Guy, did you want to come in on this?
I can. That was with regard to the last discussion, but I can.
Sorry, Guy.
I guess you know, maybe if I start with the removal of the capping proposals as. Maybe the core observation that I have with this is that I understand the notion about saying when I have deductible and taxable temporary differences that's not in scope of the initial recognition exemption in IS-12. The scenario, though, where I have equal and opposite deductible and taxable temporary differences, but there are different rates that apply to each, it strikes me as a bit different than the circumstance where I have unequal deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities because of a limitation on the amount of the DTA I can recognize. You know, I think I understand in the case where I have a constraint on the ability to recognize a DTA, the notion that that's entity specific rather than transaction specific, and a basis to distinguish that from the circumstances where the IRE would apply. I think I understand that, but in a context of a rate difference.
Thought he was pausing for a moment. Sorry, you froze there for a moment. You said
in the context
of a rate difference, and then you cut out.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes.
In the context of a rate difference on equal deductible and taxable temporary differences, conceptually that seems virtually identical to me as a scenario where I have unequal deductible and taxable temporary differences, and we're proposing to treat that those two scenarios differently under these proposals. If I just focus on that distinction, I have some difficulty distinguishing those two technically, but at the same time, if I think about this proposal from the context of you know, we already have the initial recognition exemption in IS 12. We're trying to, you know, address a problem with leases and perhaps decommissioning liabilities and whatnot, that you know, that problem has become more pervasive with the IFRS 16 accounting. The idea of recognizing all temporary differences is consistent with the general principles in IS 12. You know, what we're ultimately doing here is narrowing an exception in the standard, and you know, although the cutoff as to where we're choosing to narrow it is arguably somewhat arbitrary, given that the rate difference scenario, at least in my mind, is not much different than unequal deductible and taxable temporary differences. You know, what we're doing is making an exception to an exception, and you know, ultimately what we're talking about here are arbitrary distinctions and where we're going to draw the line with the general principles in IS 12. And you know, accepting what the paper says in paragraphs 29 and 30, that you know, doesn't the paper suggests that rate difference scenarios are not going to be all that common, or alternatively, all that material where they do arise. You know, it strikes me all in that context that although the cutoff point here is somewhat arbitrary, it's not unreasonable what we're proposing there, because again, we're starting from the point of, well, we have an exception in the standard, and we're choosing to narrow that exception. The cutoff for that is arbitrary, but recognizing we're narrowing an exception and trying to deal with the practical difficulties that have been exacerbated by IFRS 16, you know, at the end of the day, I don't find the proposals on the removal of the capping to be unreasonable, notwithstanding my comment about the cutoff being somewhat arbitrary in the case of the rate difference scenario.
Guy. Donna, did you want to come in on this topic?
Yes, thank you. So I think the first thing I noted that this was a very pragmatic approach to a rather complex situation if we were to apply the strict letter of the law of IS 12. I mean, IS 12 really does bring an incredible amount of complexity in with respect to the recognition of the deferred tax asset. And so I definitely appreciate that the suggestion to the ISB, to the board, is to actually insert this specific rule, because in reality, I think this is a rule. The removal of the cap imposes a rule into IS 12. So we're moving a little bit away from principle and moving towards a rule. And by association, removing the cap appears to imply that the asset and liability arising from a single transaction are explicitly linked, and as such, I have unique characteristics to which the general principles laid down in IS 12 do not apply. So when I was writing this and thinking a little bit about it, it's like, you know, I always view IS IFRS as a principle-based start. And what we are essentially doing is exactly to what Bob was saying, is that what Guy was saying is that exactly that. It's like we're narrowing the exception to the exception, to facilitate something that is very, very complex and make it a lot more pragmatic, which is what the users want. In all honesty, as a user of the financial of the wisdom of IFRS, if I had to do this, I would cry, having to try and track, for example, differentiating recognition of the tax asset, etc., and all those issues that were raised in the paper, which are very legitimate. So that's the one thing. I think the only thing that I would like to point out is proposing a rule-based approach for this really specific situation, should we not, in actual fact, also just kind of clear it out and say, well, you know, because the standard kind of the board said, well, you can choose whether you look first to the deferred tax asset of the right of use asset, or whether it's on the lease liability. Should we not just, in actual fact, say, listen, you look to the lease liability. You don't need to, because you're already imposing a bit of a rule here, and then you've got consistency of application across all users. And then the other question is, yes, examples are always very much appreciated by the users out there.
Thanks, Donna. And Bob?
Thanks, Sue. I agree with almost all of the staff's recommendations. I agree with the scope. I agree with removing the cap proposal. I did think about what Guy brought up. I did think about the different tax rates. I struggled with conceptually why that might go through P&L, but then as our team, you know, investigated, I have not been able to find a situation where I have that. Conceptually, I can understand how you could have it, but we haven't found one, and I think then the answer, though, is practical and simple to apply. So I agree with the staff on that. I agree with providing an example on advanced payments and initial direct costs. The one area I didn't agree with the staff was not providing an example illustrating how to determine whether the tax deduction relates to the asset or liability. I'm a tax dummy. I really struggled with that. Then I had a really smart tax guy explain to me how he would come about that, and then the light went on. I'm not sure everybody has the smart tax guy, so I would suggest providing that example. I think that would just help people, but I don't think it's fatal.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Carsten.
Yeah, very similar to what Bob just said. I think overall this is a very good compromise addressing the comments from the respondents. And so I thought this was an excellent analysis and an excellent proposal. From a practical perspective, I acknowledge it's not perhaps not perfect, but I think it's it does address the main concerns. It's very pragmatic. It's a very reasonable approach. So I would also say that some guidance on how to determine whether it relates to the asset or the liability might be helpful. But I also understand that this would encompass considering different tax jurisdictions. And so I would also say it's not, I can understand why the staff proposal is not to do anything about this. And yes, so overall, I'm very sympathetic with the proposals by the staff. And I think it's a very pragmatic solution to the issue.
Thank you, Carsten. Bertrand?
Thank you, sir. I think the, as far as I understood it, the objective of the board was to make people account for deferred tax assets at the inception date of this contract. And I swear it's rather a complex standard. And we could see with this example, this complex. I'm not sure where the complexity comes from. IFRS 16. I think it really comes from IS 12 with all those principles, then exceptions, and exceptions to the exceptions. So the initial exposure draft was adding complexity to complexity. So I think stepping back from this complexity is a good move. And I think ultimately you will end up reaching the goal of the amendments with a far more, maybe not simple, but at least a less complex way of accounting for deferred tax, for deferred taxes. So effectively, I think these last proposals go in the right direction.
Okay, thanks, Bertrand. Okay, I'm going to let people in the room in. Brian?
So I'm very keen for the board to move ahead with these proposals. I remember in February 2007, I had a new job and I went along to the very, very first meeting of the ISB's leases working group in 2007. And it was chaired, I remember, by Warren McGregor. And literally the first thing he said after good morning to kick this project off was, we're not going to talk about tax. That was the first thing he said, and there was lots of dissent in the room, and he said, no, we're not going to talk about tax. This is going to be a pre-tax standard, and the board will address tax through IS 12. So I'm very pleased that the board is addressing tax through through IS 12. In terms of the proposals in the staff paper, I was very interested in capping, and it took me a little while to get my head around the idea of removing the capping proposal, but the more I think about it, the more I like it, actually, the more it seems to make proposals as a whole simpler and more principled. And the question you're left with is assessing recoverability of the asset, but you had that anyway in the previous version of the proposals, and it is the usual issue dealing with deferred tax assets. The other point I wanted to highlight, because a few people have mentioned it, and that's attribution. So when I first looked at this, I also wondered, as some other people have, as to whether or not it would be possible to take a really simple fact pattern and just say what the attribution would be in that case. I think Bob said he'd spoken to a really smart tax man who'd explained how attribution worked, and I spoke to a really smart tax woman, actually, who completely convinced me that in a particular fact pattern, the tax needed to be attributed to the liability. And then the following day, I spoke to another really smart tax woman from another country about what sounded like the same fact pattern to me, and she told me the tax had to be attributed to the asset. And I think the real issue with attribution is you kind of need to describe, and it's always the issue with deferred tax, isn't it? You have to describe the accounting and also the underlying tax legislation in the context of that particular jurisdiction. And I'd really like to have an attribution proposal, but I honestly fear that it would be just too hard, because it would at least in part always be a commentary on the facts and circumstances of individual tax jurisdictions. Yeah. So I'm keen to go ahead. I think capping is the really big issue, and the more I think about it, the more I think removing capping is simpler and results in a more principled approach.
Lisa, do you want to say anything?
Yeah, no, I would just echo what everyone else has said about it's a very pragmatic approach that the staff has taken here, and agree with all the proposals, especially in particular, very much strongly agree with removing the capping approach, very supportive of that. Also agree with not including the examples on the assets and liabilities, and the reasons for that, and it kind of goes to what Brian was saying, is that it's going to be impacted by the jurisdictions that you're in. So coming up, you'd have to come up with so many different examples to properly illustrate this that it's probably just better letting people work through that, but supportive of the other examples around the adverse lease payments and the initial direct cost.
Okay, thank you. Okay, come back to the people on the screen. So, Young Su.
Yes, I also want to say that I support all the staff proposals. They are very reasonable and practical, I think. I especially support the removing of the capping proposal. That's very cost effective. And I think that the situation where DTL is not the same as DTA would not be often, would be very scarce. And I also strongly support providing example for the advanced lease payments and initial direct cost. Examples always help us. And especially I was really confused was about how to account for the advanced lease payments and initial direct cost. And I think the example is going to help me a lot and the others. That's all.
Thank you. Guy.
Thanks, Sue. I just wanted to add to my earlier comments to go on to say something about attribution. You know, I would observe that the removal of the capping proposal and the potential for a P&L consequence day one, does arguably elevate the importance and sensitivity of those attribution judgments in a scenario where you're going to have a constraint on the amount of the DTA you can recognize or a rate difference. And we can debate how frequent, that may or may not occur, and so I think with the removal of the capping proposal, attribution is a more sensitive matter under the proposed arrangements. That being said, I Well, it would seem ideal to embed in the standard some illustrative examples or whatnot on how to attribute the tax deduction to the asset or the liability. I can see that becoming exceedingly difficult to do, recognizing that it's going to be very tax regime specific. And so I can appreciate the position in the paper of recommending that the board continue not to, to go there. I guess I'm not necessarily against that. In an ideal world, I would love to be able to do more than what is being proposed. But again, I can understand the reluctance to do that. I think where that's going to probably leave us in practice going forward, assuming these proposals come to fruition, is I would hope, a jurisdictional consensus around how to attribute the tax deduction for the tax regime jurisdiction, and I would hope constituents within a jurisdiction, come to common judgment. That being said, we could have jurisdiction A where the jurisdiction consensus index, jurisdiction B seems very, very similar to the other jurisdiction, but the jurisdictional consensus is different. But I think that is probably going to just be a fact of life, and there are arguably many other circumstances today where we have similar jurisdictional judgments on the tax regimes and rules in place that are being applied, and you start to align those regimes against each other and debate whether those consensuses are consistent or not. I think that is a problem very likely in many circumstances today. So I'm not sure we're introducing a new problem that's not already present. So long and short is I tend to agree with the recommendation in the paper that it's really going to be exceedingly different further than what is proposed, albeit in a perfect world it would sure be nice to be able to, but I just can't see it.
Thank you, Guy. John?
Maybe just 2 points. I agree. I think that the paper is I think, a very thoughtful and good analysis, but maybe just one comment on the capping matter, which I agree with conceptually, but in paragraph 29 of the paper, it talks about the possibility of tax planning opportunities. I guess I would just like to comment that in situations where companies may have only partial recognition of assets, the tax assets, or no recognition of deferred tax assets, it's quite likely that they've fully explored all possible tax planning opportunities that could allow for the recognition of the assets to begin with. So I wouldn't want to minimize the possibility that you could have situations now with the removal of a cap that you'd recognize a DTL, but not a DTA. Because I think it may be more common than one might expect. The other point, while I appreciate the complexity of developing illustrative guidance or some thoughts around the considerations to assess or the considerations when attributing whether a temporary difference is attributable to the lease asset or lease liability, I do think something is needed. Right, I think the principle itself will be very challenging for people to conceptualize and to implement in a consistent way. So I do think we have to find, I would encourage the staff and the board to find something to provide to users to just help make the principle a bit clearer and without getting prescriptive and whilst respecting the differences that certainly do exist from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I think a way just to help give people a bit of a framework to think about how to go through that attribution would be very helpful.
Thank you. Jens?
Thank you so much, Fam. I only can echo what has been said. So I fully agree with the analysis, and I'm supportive of going forward with the proposed approach.
Okay, thank you. Sophie? I think you might be on mute, Sophie. Can't hear you. All right. Can't understand Sophie's sign language, but I think it means she can't unmute. So I'm sure she'll reach out to Gustavo if she has something specific that she wants raised. So I think that is the input. So Gustavo, hopefully that's helpful for you.
So I think we also have the 3B, I'm not sure if all committee members also comment on if they have any comments on transition and scope.
Okay. Do you want to tee that up or just hand, so just move on to 3B?
Yeah, I think some already commented in 3B, but maybe if any committee members had anything else.
Had any else specific on transition? Gustavo's obviously hoping for a detailed discussion of the dream combination of IES 12 and transition. I don't see much excitement and appetite for that, Gustavo. I'm sorry.
Surprisingly.
Okay, I think... No. Guy's going to take you up on it. Guy.
Maybe a comment on the transition proposals. I think broadly the direction in the paper makes a lot of sense. It will really ease transition for lease arrangements and decommissioning obligations by following the approach laid out in the paper. And then the notion of prospective application for other arrangements with equal deductible and taxable temporary differences, I think, aids transition for those if we accept the scope, including those arrangements. And, that will presumably help, someone going through some sort of exhaustive retrospective search for scenarios where in other cases there were equal deductible and taxable temporary differences on initial recognition of particular transaction. That being said, there was an aspect of the prospective proposals that wasn't entirely clear to me. They reference that we're recommending that it be applied prospectively to a transaction, and so I wasn't sure precisely what we meant by transaction, and then also I wasn't entirely sure if we were intending that the choice of prospective had to be applied consistently to all transactions, however we define transactions. And so the example that struck me as potentially relevant to sort of helping think through that is the, I think in one of the papers, and I can't remember which one, there was an example given of capitalized interest, where I'm capitalizing interest under IAS 23, but recognizing a liability for that interest at the time I capitalize it. And when we say transaction in that context, does transaction mean, each dollar of interest capitalized, or would transaction mean, the qualifying asset? And so if on transition I have an in-process activity going on for a qualifying asset, I'm constructing some qualifying asset that's in process, when I refer to prospective application, I'm only looking for new qualifying assets that arise after transition, or is the transaction, the next dollar of interest I capitalize on that qualifying asset after transition? If it's the latter, the prospective application is going to result in a mixed model being applied to a single asset, an item of PP&E. If it applies to a new qualifying asset, then I, perhaps I'm not going to have a mixed model for that particular qualifying asset when it comes to the tax accounting and the application of these proposals. And then secondly, you know, if I compare that particular transaction to other transactions, you know, prospective versus retrospective on other transactions, you know, a different perspective as to what may be more manageable for an entity to apply may differ. So again, I wasn't sure if prospective meant consistently to all transactions or whether there was some, you know, class of transaction choice, et cetera. So, you know, again, I broadly agree directionally with the proposal in the paper, but, you know, trying to think through prospective application and ensuring that is really going to be manageable for entities and offering, you know, perhaps some further guidance or flexibility around those two points in terms of what is a transaction and, you know, can prospective or retrospective be applied by class of transaction, I think might be helpful or very, very helpful for entities to navigate.
Gustavo, have you got what you need now?
Yeah, so thank you.
Okay. Taxman's happy. That's good. Okay, that's good. So I look forward to seeing the revamped version of that as a board member at some point in time.